Hello, hello. Welcome to the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rogiro, the chef in the hat.
I am chef owner of a few of Seattle's fine joints right now. We have our Sirius takeout in Ballard at 52nd 14th Northwest, where we have Sirius Pie featured and our dinner box program and all sorts of deliciousness happening out there. Also, in downtown, we are back open at Sirius Pie Downtown, which is between 3rd and 4th on Virginia Street. And yesterday, just yesterday, we opened Seatown Market and Fish Fry.
Oh, great.
Down there on the corner of the north corner of the Pike Place Market. So if you have ever driven through the Pike Place Market, drive all the way through the three main blocks of the market. And then right when you turn at Virginia and Western, we're right there on the corner, Seatown Market and Fish Fry. I got to say, Chef, and I'm curious, I want you to come down and try them, but I think they're the best fish and chips I've ever had.
You know what? I'll be there as soon as I can.
Yeah, come check them out.
Are you open all day?
We're open noon to 7 every day, okay. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Cool.
Because that's when the market's at its peak. And, you know, we're still struggling downtown for people. There's a lot of places, but not many people.
Oh, yeah.
We're hoping people come down and try our fish and chips. I think it's really good. And, you know, I don't blow up like that very often on my own stuff. So that one was in particular. We use a Saison beer, and we use a mixture of different flours. I'm not going to tell you our secret recipe.
Toasted or not toasted?
And, of course, some of our delicious smoked paprika in the batter. So if you've never tried our fish and chips, now's the time to check it out. Of course, they're not chips anymore. They're tots, chips and tots.
Chips and tots.
Well, you know, it's funny with the
you
new
mean
business
fish and
model.
Tots.
Fish and chops, yeah, sorry.
Fish and tots.
The new business model, you know, because you're working over at Luke, everything has to be more efficient because you can't afford all the people because you're not sure if you're going to do any business. And so until we build back up to some level of
regularity.
Yeah, revenue that we can count on, then you have to just do what you can do. And,
that's right.
And so we're excited to be open. We saw a lot of our regulars that live in the neighborhood yesterday. It was super fun. We're also going to invite Ron Alvarado, co-founder of Fix Hard Seltzer, to the show today. I like it because it has real fruit juice in it.
Correct.
Compared to some of the hard ciders people have brought to us to try, this one actually has real flavorings instead of
tastes good.
Yeah, instead of chemical flavors, and I like that. And they're sourcing some fruit from Washington. We're going to catch up with Jen Doak, owner of Ballard's Brimmer and Heel Tap, and her new adventure in the back there where she had her kind of private dining rooms and outdoor patio and all stuff. She's opened the Red Arrow Coffee back there, so you can sit and have a coffee and enjoy the sunshine. And
can't wait to hear.
Yeah, everyone's kind of morphing, right? Everyone's doing what they need to do to kind of get it back together again. Our Pass It Down segment continues with an old family recipe from the Netherlands, which calls for too much butter.
No such a thing.
According to the person who Maddie talked to them, and they actually made food that sort of made them ill, but they loved it because it was a family recipe. I love that. I did a similar thing last night at my class here at Hot Stove. I did Grandma Dot's eggplant parmesan, and with my own little twist. So I'm thinking I'm going to pass it down. Yeah. Lastly, today we're going to continue our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge, brought to you by Rub with Love, handcrafted, versatile rubs, sauces, and mustards that I happen to make that add a flavorful kick and a whole lot of love to just about any meat, fish, or vegetable. That's rubwithlove.com. Okay, Chavi, taste of the week.
Oh, it's got to be those eggplants you brought me from Prosser Farm.
Now, my wife called and said, thank you. My wife called and said, do you think Terry would want some of this produce? I have so much.
Oh,
I said,
my God.
Do I think?
Yes. Thank you, Jackie. Thank you very, very much. It's, I mean, it is such a, to me, it's always a great pleasure to have a farmer come at the back of the house and bring me peaches or haricot vert or lettuces or whatever that just still has the dew, still fresh. It's beautiful. It's, you can tell it's loved,
right.
You know? And it comes all the way to you. And now you're like, okay, so I got to not screw this up. I got to make something good with this, right?
Right.
And, man, you brought me that tote of eggplant. And
ours didn't have dew. Ours has dust on it.
Oh, yeah, no, it's plenty.
It is from the desert.
Yeah, but, I mean, that's fine. You just rinse it off. And I took those eggplants and made a wonderful, what I call a Mediterranean salad, because I didn't know what else to call it.
Caponata type thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, tomatoes, peppers, olives, lemon confit. Mm-hmm. And all those grilled, I grilled the eggplant, so I salted the eggplant on both sides. I skinned them.
Why do you skin them?
Because I tried them with the skin on, and I was like, you know, I'm going to skin them for that salad.
For the salad, yeah.
So I skinned them, I grilled them, I salted them on both sides for about an hour, pat them super dry, beautiful amount of olive oil, and then grill them char, you know, give them a nice little char on both sides, and then dice them in big pieces, and then mix that into my salad at the last minute. And I served that with some prawns, sauteed prawns. Ooh, that was fresh. That was scrumptious. Summertime. It's cream summertime. I put a bunch of anise, hyssop, mint, and basil into the chopped herb that I put in there at the last minute. Lots of beautiful Moroccan olive oil.
Sounds delicious.
That was so fresh. And thank you again for that, because that was...
Well, what's interesting about that, and I asked why you skinned them, because these are in particular about half the size of the ones you see at the grocery store, right? They're a globe eggplant, but they're half the size.
Correct.
And so they're a little bit sweeter, and the skin is more tender. And so I understand from your salad perspective. Did you try the Hannah's Choice melons?
Oh, my God.
Aren't they good?
Oh, I've been eating it every day. Kathy took one home, and I was like, any employee was like cutting it at the end of service.
Yeah.
And go, you guys need to try it. It is so sweet.
So fragrant and sweet.
Here's how I'm doing this.
This is our seventh year growing those melons.
Jambon de Bayonne.
Yep.
Feta cheese. So a little bit of feta crumbled on top of the melon.
Nice salty against the sweet.
A little bit of olive oil.
Yeah.
Jambon de Bayonne, you know, thinly sliced, like a prosciutto idea. And then a little glaze. Then I have a maple... glaze reduced down, and then drizzle that just a little bit on top. Oh my God, big success. Cracked pepper right on top of that.
Oh,
beautiful. I mean, so scrumptious, and not too much ham. You know, the ham is kind of like bringing that little meat, cured meat contrast to the melon, but the melon is the star.
Right.
Beautiful melon.
And last night I made those little marble potatoes that we gave you. Last night I made those for my class. I steamed them in white wine, just melted a little goat butter on top, which adds a whole kind of fragrance
that
I really enjoy, and fresh chives. And so you've got a little plethora there of things that are really good. And
thank you, Prosser Farm.
As long as you keep those potatoes cold, they'll be fine for weeks.
Oh, they're almost gone.
Oh, are they really? You've got two totes today.
Fried in duck fat.
You know. All right, up next, Ron Alvarado of Fix Hard Seltzer is going to join us by telephone and tell us about his project of coming from the Bay Area or North California or something on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio. Tom Douglas here.
Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat, also here.
You are the chef in the chapeau. You are very consistent. Summer, winter, fall.
When you have no hair like me, a hat is very welcome.
You should be proud of your head, the shape of your head. You look awesome. We are going to be joined by Ron Alvarado from Fix Hard Seltzer. Terry, you and I have been watching the seltzer craze kind of run its course over the last few years. Some local people, Ethan Stoll, got involved in a seltzer company. Certainly the White Claw is probably the most famous one out there that is around the country. But none of them have I liked, I got to say. Not that I don't like Ethan's. It's just, I shouldn't say like is the wrong word. None of them have blown me away.
Right.
And maybe I'm just not a seltzer person. I don't know. But these are really delicious. And I like them because they taste like real fruit rather than like a chemical-based or a natural oil base, which can be intense or kind of off-putting to me. These taste like the fruit that are the pictures that are on the label. So let's invite Ron on and find out what he's got to say about that and how he achieved such a goal, which is to get that natural flavoring. Hi, Ron.
Good morning, Ron.
Hey, guys. Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. You're coming to us from where?
I am in San Francisco, California right now.
Nice. Did you get hopefully you weren't chased out from the fires up north of there or south of there?
Very grateful that we're okay here in San Francisco. We're just kind of dealing with the smoke, but, you know, can't complain compared to the alternative. So we're hoping that everyone can get these under control. It's a pretty rough situation these days. But, good here in San Francisco.
Good. So tell us about how Fix came about, Hard Seltzer, and your partner and your college roommate and all the good things that are the stories behind many, many small businesses.
Yeah, it kind of goes way back. And, I mean, we're about as... We started as small as it gets. My roommate in college, he was actually from Medina, and that's kind of like our big Washington connection. And we kind of just had this idea of like cutting sugar from cocktails. At the time, this is like 10 years ago, there weren't too many alternatives and there were no like nutrition panels on drinks. And it just seemed a little weird to us because that was something that was big into other food and beverages. So we kind of just like went down that road and eventually it led us over to hard seltzers. And your kind of take on like the kind of not that being impressed with the flavor, like kind of chemically based, is kind of like what we thought too when we were trying these things a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And so we decided like, let's just go a different route here. We love the idea of like low sugar, low calories, and what these kind of bigger brands are doing to create the category. But let's put some like real authentic ingredients in here so that it tastes a little bit more like what you'd expect. And that kind of led us to this kind of like methodology of using real fruit juice for flavoring. And that's really kind of the core of our company, and kind of our main differentiator for us in the hard seltzer space, which gets more crowded every single day.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Definitely getting complicated to get through that one at the eye. Yeah. In the Isle of Seltzer, it's getting complicated.
But it also must be something that the major companies think that they need one of these in their portfolio when they walk into a restaurant to try and sell wine, beer, cider, and now seltzer. They have to fill out their portfolios.
Yeah, absolutely. And even companies that you wouldn't even expect the alcohol in, with Coke's coming out with one now and these other brands that had never made alcohol before, it's really just kind of like a vacuum that people are going into. It's something that, we're relatively new in the spectrum of like Budweiser, these brands that have been around for 100 years, but it's something that I don't think you've really seen in the alcohol space in terms of like such fast growth, that we think is going to stick around for a while just because it has kind of all those check boxes of how people are eating and drinking better these days in terms of calories and carbs, but we wanted it to taste good at the same time. And so that was kind of our whole thing, is like go source great ingredients from great places, some of which are from Washington and Oregon too, which we're really proud of, and really just try to make it taste good and keep those calories low.
What are you getting locally here from Washington that our farmers are growing?
All the berries. Okay. The berries up in the Pacific Northwest, you just can't top them. So I know like our cranberries come from like the Grays Harbor area, mm-hmm, of Washington. We also get some kind of in like the Bandon area of Oregon. And the blackberries come from like kind of like Northwest Oregon, Southwest Washington. Okay. So basically our whole like thing is we have this like kind of concept of called like farm to fizz, kind of like in vein of farm to fork, where
farm to fizz. We won. Give it up.
Yeah. It came out after a few fix a couple years ago, that tagline. It's getting to know the people that are actually growing our ingredients and really using authentic ingredients as opposed to just like natural flavors or things that you'll see from other brands. So we kind of like keep that in our mind when we're making new flavors or finding new suppliers. And that's kind of, I think it comes through on the taste.
Right.
Well, I really, personally really enjoy the grapefruit. I like the bitterness from the grapefruit. It's exactly what I would expect from a grapefruit drink. So
awesome.
I think,
I'm glad you like it.
I really like the way you nailed that one down, that flavor specifically, because I think citrus is definitely, especially in seltzer, is definitely something that you find that is not, doesn't seem true to the flavor to me.
Yeah, so many things like flavored with lime to me, like even if you go like to Mike and Ike's or something right. like that, Lime is a particularly hard one, I think, unless you're using real juice, because it just doesn't taste real, and this tastes real.
Right. I also really enjoyed the berry, the blackberry. Mm-hmm. I think the flavor is definitely true as well. It's a hard flavor to get through, I think, but it's definitely really cool on the flavor. So
awesome. I'm glad you liked it. Yeah. When we looked at this, it's like taste was not just like the taste. It's also like a mouthfeel thing, where like when you mentioned citrus, like everyone knows what it's like to bite into a lemon or even a lime. Like it's not just the taste. It's like a reaction in your mouth. And so like, I think when you talk about like lime flavored things or grapefruit flavored things, like, yeah, you can make the flavor like sound kind of similar to that, but like real fruit is just a different kind of aspect to it, where you get that kind of mouthfeel and the kind of like reaction to it. So we think that like the real fruit aspect is not just like a flavor thing, but like it just reminds you of the fruit because it is. Right. So that's kind of like our big thing and sticking with that. So we're going to keep making some new flavors, but it'll always kind of be around that concept of like find the best fruit, like make this taste authentic and, you know, avoid that kind of chemically taste that we saw a little bit too much of. And that's kind of why we decided to launch it.
We're talking with Ron Alvarado of Fix, F-I-C-K-S, Hard Cider. And, Ron, we only have a couple of minutes left. How else would you use this? I know you could sit down and pour yourself a glass of it, but do you have a favorite mixed beverage that you make out of one of your seltzers?
Yeah, I actually really like using the lime for sparkling margaritas. We make like a still margarita mix at Fix too, but the lime seltzer has actually been really great for, you know, just throw like a little bit of extra tequila in it. Mm-hmm. And it's really, I mean, it's only one carb in our can of lime. So it's like a nice, like light, like sparkling margarita. So I'll do that a lot, as well as like a cranberry vodka. Mm-hmm. The cranberries we get from Pac Northwest are just so, so good. And so just adding like a little extra charge to that can be pretty nice. But, it's been cool to see like out in the market, people get more creative than we do. Like we've seen people mixing flavors together and making like a cran lime kind of cocktail, or mixing up the grapefruit with something. So it's definitely like a nice base for like cocktails as well as just kind of drinking straight from the can.
Right. And they're 5% alcohol, so they're not super heavy. You can drink a couple of these without having to go to bed, which is always
if you're like us.
Yeah, exactly. We wanted to be able to enjoy it. They're pretty sessionable. So it's like, 5% is kind of like a nice, not the industry standard for seltzers randomly, but it's kind of like nice where you can enjoy a few of these things, and as you said,
okay, you're starting to break up, so if you could sit still for me for one last question, I just have 30 seconds.
Sure, sorry about that.
Where do people buy it in this neighborhood?
So QFC is probably our biggest retailer in the Pacific Northwest. We just launched with QFC, but then you can also find it in Total Wine and BevMo stores.
Okay.
But we just launched up there just about a month or two ago, so we're working on getting some more stores as well.
Sounds great. Get out there and find some Fix, F-I-C-K-S, hard seltzer, and enjoy it. Thanks, Ron, for coming on the show.
Congratulations.
Thank you guys very much. Have a great weekend.
All right. See you later. Up next, right, Jen cheers. Doak is here from Ballard's Brimmer and Heel Tap and the new Red Arrow Coffee. Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. We're back in the Hot Stove Society Radio Show. Tom Douglas.
Jerry Rotorola, the chef in the hat.
Glad to be coming to you from the Hot Stove Society. We are open for business, by the way. Chef and I, Chef Terry and I did a class here on the 16th of August.
That's right.
Celebrating Julia's 108th birthday, Julia Child.
And she's holding well.
And we have continued on pretty much nightly here. So if you ever want to come and take a virtual class, just go to hotstovesociety.com and enjoy the show. I did one last night featuring my wife, and I did one featuring the produce of Prosser Farm, and we did what we called the rainbow platter.
That should be glorified because those produce are beautiful.
Yeah, super fun. Jen Doak is here of Brimmer and Heel Tap over there in Ballard. If you're an old Ballardite, you'll remember the location as the location for Le Gourmand restaurant back when. And then, Jen, what was behind Le Gourmand? Is Sam's?
Sambar. It was the adjacent, not
right.
Behind was Bruce used it as like dry storage.
Okay, yeah, the adjacent space.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
And you have had that space now for a good 5 years, is my guess.
I know, we're almost 7 years.
Almost 7 years.
Yes.
Yeah. So one of the remarkable things about the COVID crisis and closing all of the restaurant businesses is how restaurateurs are starting to respond and react and re-engage and invigorate their neighborhoods again. And so tell us about your story, what happened, and where you are now as far as re-engaging.
Well, I mean, it is a kind of a blessing and a curse to have to use your creativity, right? Like with something so tragic. Ultimately, I mean, we have this beautiful, charming garden that I felt was critical that we have day and night use for. So we created a little coffee shop. Sitting out back of our garden that is so beautiful, if I do say so myself, teaming up with Cafe Umbria to supply beautiful Italian roasted coffee, and we have pulled espresso, we have a full-time baker. It's a really charming use of the space. I really enjoy it.
You brought us some muffins, and if this is an example of what you're serving,
it is.
I would encourage anyone to go there.
Oh, thank you.
These Drake. Delicious.
Oh, Drake is our full-time baker, and he made these fresh this morning. This is my grandma's sour cream blueberry muffin recipe.
Delicious.
They look fabulous, too. They came nestled in a little to-go box. It looked like half a dozen eggs.
I know.
It's like so lovely. What's the plan then? So you've got this coffee shop. Now, you weren't open for breakfast before.
We were only open for weekend brunch.
Okay.
And due to the volume and like social distancing, we just did not feel that was prudent. So the coffee shop allows us to have a spread out like enjoyment of the space with people feeling safe. It's easy for people to come in and grab something to go. Mm-hmm. It's you can order online. It gives people the ability to use us throughout the day versus just just for dinner.
So if you were to, if somebody were to not know where the old Legramondo is, what's the cross street there? You're at Market and
6th Avenue Northwest, right where the Market Street turns at that kind of sharp pin, mm-hmm. that hairpin turn there, right by Verace Pizza as well.
Okay. So, yeah, you go up the hillside there, up into the Fremont neighborhood and head over to Aurora. That's why I drive by there all the time. Can't wait to stop.
Oh,
yeah.
Thank you.
It's going to be awesome.
There's a great little history with the name, too. We decided to rebrand it as Red Arrow Coffee.
Uh-huh.
It is part of Bremer and Hilltap versus some folks have asked if it's a pop-up for a different business, but it is part of our business. Mm-hmm. The name, however, just because of the rich history of the building. You know, Bruce had it for nearly 30 years, and before that, there were a number of businesses. Unbeknownst to us, it was a grocery store back in the 20s and 30s, and one of our founders that bought the real estate with us, he had no idea that it was his great-grandpa's. So unknowingly bought the building with us that was once his great-grandpa's old grocery store.
Wow.
So hanging above the sign of his great-grandpa's grocery store is a sign that says Red Arrow Superior Wafers.
Uh-huh.
And so we decided to name the coffee shop after that homage to history.
That is such a freaky thing to have.
It's really his mom dug up a picture of his great-grandpa in front of the very doors that we now call Bremer and Hilltap. Uh-huh. It's really eerie.
It's funny how those little things happen. The other day at the dock at our Sirius Takeout, the guy came up and, you know, we get people's names when they order their pizzas, right? So that we can call out their names. And his last name was Fiorino. I said, that's funny. The original name of this building is the Fiorino building. And so then I said, is there any relationship? And he didn't know. So he called his wife and found out that, yeah, it was
her
grandfather's building. Yeah. And he had no idea.
And it all sparks from a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could have easily overlooked that detail, or somebody else might have missed that, and they would have never known. I love that.
So Bremer and Hilltap isn't coming back just as Red Arrow Coffee. That's just the morning business. So what else are your plans planning to do there?
We are open for dinner service Thursday through Sunday for Bremer and Hilltap's dinner, which is an amazing summer menu right now. I'm mostly seated in the garden, a few tables inside. And that's Thursday through Sunday from 4 to 10 p.m.
4 to 10. There's not many places open until 10 anymore.
I lied. It's 4 to 9 p.m.
4 to 9 p.m.
Yep. That was hours. I know.
Like, I don't know if you heard me say earlier that all of us are adjusting, you know, to a business plan and model where you can't take the risk anymore of, say, staying open that extra hour from 9 to 10 where you might only do two or three people because you can't afford to pay the labor, you know, because you don't have the really full business during dinner time.
Right. Well, and now with the restrictions of not being able to have alcohol service
after 10,
yeah. If somebody walks into the dining room at, you know, 5 minutes to nine, we're going to serve them a full meal. They'll still be able to enjoy a glass of wine or something at this point. But if our hours were until 10, they wouldn't be able to.
So, you know, here's news. I didn't know that was the case.
Oh, yeah, that is.
There's no alcohol after 10, huh?
No.
Well, we don't have anything open that way,
well,
so I don't know.
I think it's been like at least a month since that happened.
Yeah.
Then the governor said no service alcohol after 10.
I think they just changed. I think in the last like 48 hours, I did see something come through that we can do takeout after 10 o'clock, like takeout liquor sales, but nothing consumed on property.
I wonder how much of that
is.
You know, I love your menu. To me, it's the way of the future, the way your menu reads and the way it looks like it would eat, where you have a little plate of snap peas, or you got a little plate of roasted beets, or a little plate of fingerling potatoes, you know, really focused on deliciousness, freshness. I'm sure they're all farm raised, but you know what I mean, small farmer raised.
Yeah.
And heirloom tomato salad, just simple things. And when we do things that simple, we can bring the prices down a little bit, it seems like to me, right? So your prices are so reasonable, $10 a pop.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, and we're working with some great local farmers. One of my favorite dishes right now is that albacore tuna that's local. We just brought in these beautiful Armenian cucumbers grown out of Sound Vegetables in Redmond, and they're absolutely stunning.
And what makes a stunning cucumber to you? Like, is it less bitter? Is it more sweet?
Well, I was educated that an Armenian cucumber is actually not a cucumber.
Uh-huh.
It's actually part of the muskmelon family.
Oh.
And it looks like a cucumber, kind of tastes like a cucumber. It's a little firmer. It's really special.
So it's going to be sweeter, right, because it's a melon?
It, It tastes like a cucumber. Yeah. It really is. Like, if you didn't know that it was part of the muskmelon family, you would probably think it was a cucumber.
Yeah, it's more watery. Than it's not sweet like a melon. Mm. Not what we think of a melon.
Terry, I see on the menu she's got confit chicken.
Oh.
What do you think about that?
What could you do? What could I do about that? I would make a reservation and show up.
That is our chef, Levi. That's his favorite dish on the menu right now. It's so delicious. There are these little drumsticks that are served with a local squash salad coming out of Faith Beyond in Kent.
Uh-huh.
And it's really delicious, served with a little, what is that? It's a little salsa verde on there.
I'm with you, Tom. I think that kind of dishes is where it's at. Like, you more and more, people are focusing on what they're getting the day of, processing the goods, and then, okay, what are we going to do tomorrow? There's a lot of that. I mean, I see it in my restaurant. You mm-hmm. know, I do. Last night, I think I had 6 specials, which is too many, but I just happened to have 6 of them. Well, between the appetizer, the dessert, and the entrees, I just end up having 6, and my server were looking at me, 2 guys, and they're looking at me like, chef, that might be I'm like, hey, we don't have to say
it's like
it all.
Giving a sermon at the table.
It's not. I said, just do 2, and then go back and say, oh, by the way, there's another 2. And then don't do the dessert until you get to the end.
So, Jen, I don't want to run out of time before you tell me about these wine and cheese boxes that you're doing that are so interesting here. You said Alison Lieber, formerly of Brie and Bordeaux, years
yes,
and years ago
I
in
know.
The Tanglewood neighborhood. You have to be old to know that. I am. And the wine that you brought, let's talk about that for a second.
Of course. We have a wonderful monthly wine club. And it is 3 wines or 6 wines, and we are hand-selecting them, small producers. They have a sense of place. They have a sense of varietal. We are so excited about each and every wine. And starting next month, we're offering a cheese club to go with it. So Allison has graciously teamed up with us to offer 3 cheeses or 6 cheeses to a company, and we couldn't
Very
be more excited.
Cool idea.
And do people find out about that how?
Through our website at brimmerandheeltap.com.
That's B-R-I-M-M-E-R and ampersand, H-E-E-L-T-A-P, brimmerandheeltap.com. So fun to have you here. I'm excited about
thank
your
you.
Future.
So great to see you guys.
It's great to see some leadership out there doing interesting foods and making the adjustments needed to stay alive.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's awesome.
All the best.
Thank you.
Up next, we have our traditional pass it down. Don't let the recipe box die with you. Pass down your family recipe. And Maddie's been on the phone with somebody who has a recipe from the Netherlands on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Hot Stove Society radio show. Tom Douglas and the chef in the chapeau, Mr. Terry Rotero here.
That is correct, Tom.
Terry, do you have a family recipe that has been handed down to you that you have actually used the way it was, or did you modify everything?
Slightly modified. The pot-au-feu from my mother is something for years. I would, even in the summertime, I'd say, oh, make me that pot-au-feu. You know, and my mother would go, well, I don't have all the ingredients, and it's too hard to make it. But it's a dish that I love to make. I don't make it as often as I want to.
Mm-hmm. The season is coming.
Right.
Don't rush the season for pot-au-feu.
No, I'm not.
Yeah.
But it's a beautiful dish. It's kind of like my idea of, I think that's why I like pho so much, especially the oxtail pho at Babar.
Mm-hmm.
Why I like it so much, because it reminds me of that, the brothy meat kind of dish that I was raised with. And it's a memory.
Well, this segment is called Pass It Down. Don't let the recipe box die with you, right? And so the idea is that family heirloom recipes are not just ingredients listed on an index card, right? They're memories. They're times and places when you've had that dish. They are like an earthly energy in a funny way that puts you in a place in your head when you're making it. You remember grandma teaching you. You remember sitting at the table with the family eating it under the Christmas tree with the cookie presents, you know.
There is a story with the recipe.
Yeah. So that's what this segment is about. And Madeline, our producer, why don't you explain how people can send in their family heirloom recipe that's important to them?
Definitely. We've been getting a lot of really fun recipes, so I encourage people to still send them in. They can either post them to our Facebook page at the Hot Stove Society Radio Show, or you can also email us at hotstoveradio@tomdouglas.com. And we had a listener this week email about her husband's family recipe from the Netherlands, and she actually said, "This calls for too much butter." I said, "Well, we have a couple of chefs who can help you out here."
Yeah, no kidding.
So I can tell you a little bit about it. We they ended up getting a CSA box with a bunch of kale lately, and it reminded her husband, Mike, of a family recipe that he used to cook from the Netherlands. His father was from the Netherlands, rather, and they used to make a dish called Boerenkool Stump Pot, which is basically like a Dutch mash of potato and kale with a sausage butter gravy drizzled over the top of it. And it was revealed at the time that now both the sausage butter gravy made both she and her husband quite ill. She did not like the amount of butter that was used.
Did they know it all these years? And they just put their finger on it.
Known it all these years, but they never revealed it to each other, she said.
Because they didn't want to offend anybody.
They didn't want to offend each other. They even traveled back to the Netherlands. And, you know, the town that they lived in have all these beautiful farmers markets and cheeses. But she says almost every recipe from her grandmother calls for a kilo of butter. And it's
that's
just
2 pounds.
That's over 2 pounds. Yeah, exactly.
It's fulfilled.
Exactly. So she says that basically they've never been able to find a duplicate recipe online. What they've been able to do is you cook the kale after you de-stem it with the potatoes, and as it's mashing, then you cook the sausage in the butter, which she claims she doesn't know how, but it creates this type of gravy that then they pour
just
over
a little
the mash.
Flour.
Exactly. But they're really looking for a way to pass it down to their youngest child, who is a more ambitious cook. They feel like they need a little bit of an update on some herbs or different types of vegetables to use, and then maybe a different type of protein instead of the sausage, because she just says it's too rich, it's too much for them. So any advice for you, it's passed over.
So I wonder if they're using the kind of potato sausages that are so common in Scandinavia. So I was curious about that.
Yeah.
when I read that.
If you use a good sausage, first of all, you don't have to keep it as a sausage. You could open the casing and break it down and cook it with much, much less butter because it's not as big.
Well. So let's stop for 1 second.
Yeah.
You can't just tear apart their family recipe. The butter was a traditional
ingredient. No. I'm not saying don't use butter. I'm saying less butter.
Yeah,
Sausage.
So can we? I'm just going to ask you to go back a little bit.
Okay.
When you read this in the beginning, you said, "Yeah, I know how to make that gravy," because we couldn't figure out how do you saute a sausage or poach a sausage in butter and the butter becomes a gravy. Now, she didn't say that they add flour. So tell me, is there something in the juices of the sausage mixed with the butter that kind of creates some sort of gravy-like substance?
It would be more like a jus, but not a gravy. It wouldn't be thick. So the thickness has to come from a starch.
So maybe it is potato sausage. Maybe there's starch coming out of potato sausage.
Maybe it is. Then it would be a completely different story because it's not. She says calabasas. She names a few sausages.
Uh-huh.
She says use any sausages. So if you're using a true sausage, there's not flour enough in a sausage to create a gravy from all that butter.
Right.
But you could actually make a little quick gravy with using a little flour. Or
right.
If you were using...
But if you do that and you just have butter, it's not going to be much of a gravy. It's going to be a paste.
Exactly. It's going to be more like a roux.
Yeah, so we don't want that either.
No, we don't want that. So personally, I would stay away from any thickener of any kind. You don't need it. Now, have you cooked with potato sausage?
I have.
Because I haven't.
Cooked it in a thing of butter to see if it thickens up a sauce or not.
Right.
But I could see where the starch was. But here, on top of that, it might not be potato sausage because they're putting it on top of mashed kale and potatoes.
Right.
It's just an interesting dilemma if there isn't some sort of stock or even water used. So, like, if they do use a little bit of flour and a little bit of water, then now you can see where that butter could turn into a gravy, right?
Right.
It'd be rich gravy, but...
That would be definitely very rich. So I think another outtake you could do, especially today, would be to take that sausage and open it up.
Okay.
And then saute it into your butter, which would be using half the amount of butter, because you're not cooking a big sausage and braise it.
Mm-hmm.
She said braised in butter. I mean, that's a lot of butter.
Yeah.
I can see that.
Mm-hmm.
But you could use the ground sausage meat into butter and then cook it the same way and then finish with a bunch of fresh herb and add that to your mashed kale and potato at the end. And I think that would create a nice dish that would be very much up to date.
You know, I thought it was funny when reading that recipe, Madeline, how she described how her husband would take every vein out of the kale because that's the way grandma did it, right? Because at the time, you can see possibly that their kale was much tougher than the stuff that we get now. Right. And so you don't even need to take even the big stem off of kale hardly anymore, especially the like lacinato kale or things like that. So it's cute how these family recipes end up getting all the way through the system,
totally.
No pun intended,
and
can become something different. So we always talk about updating recipes with fresh herbs.
Right. To me, I think...
What is Bubble and Squeak? What is that Irish dish that has kind of broccoli and mashed potatoes together? Reminding me of some dish like that.
The squeak is cheese, right?
Yeah.
It is called... It has a funny name. I'll have to
I forget what that is. The kind of broccoli mashed potatoes. I love the idea. I love mashed potatoes. I love them the next day. I like the idea of saving some of that butter and taking the mash and making mashed potato kale mashed potato pancakes out of them.
Are there other types of vegetables in a CSA box that you could probably put together in a mashed potato? What are some other
Is also Swiss chard that are very common right now in my backyard. There's plenty of it. So that's another green leaf that you can add to it. Spinach are very big. And one thing that would be really cool in that is to add a little bit of sorrel. If you have any sorrel... Because sorrel is really bright lemon flavor. So you put a couple of those into your mashed potato. That would brighten your mashed potato very strongly.
But sorrel turns blackish gray, right? Is that going to bother?
No, you mash it with everything else. It will be fine. All not.
I like the idea of taking your sorrel and pureeing it in the blender, raw like that, with lemon juice, and then dripping that over top of this kind of well-cooked mashed potato. That would really brighten the whole dish.
That would cut through that richness for sure. Yeah.
Indeed.
Bubble and Squeak.
Bubble and Squeak. So it is with broccoli mash, right?
Yep. Yeah, mashed potatoes, Marilyn.
This sounds like a family heirloom.
It's true.
I would embrace it and make it your own, and exactly what they're asking to do. Bo Ren Cool Stomp Pot. Cute. Well, keep them coming. We love hearing your family stories and the recipes that shouldn't die with you. They should be passed on along with the rest of your recipe box. Up next, it's our second hour. We're going to talk to the folks from Food Lifeline. We're going to talk to, we're going to eat some mac and cheese, sadly. And we're going to do our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Hot Stove Society Radio Show. Your hosts, Tom Douglas.
And Thierry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
Happy to be here. We're going to talk about one of my favorite subjects for the next few segments. Which is Food Lifeline. You and I both have an affinity.
And to me too.
Yeah, we have an affinity for Food Lifeline. And I think that our affinity probably mirrors why we do it, which is, for me, I've been involved for on and off for most of 40 years now. And the why we do it is that I've always felt like it's great that people can afford to come into our restaurants, but it's doesn't let us off the hook to feed everyone out there. And
it's about feeding people.
Yeah, exactly. So... Is that the same way you feel about it?
Like 100%. I mean, I can't fathom. I've been in this country for over 40 years now, and I just can't fathom having people not eat to their need in America. That just doesn't fly. Just doesn't.
So in the next segment, we're going to talk to Linda Najat, the executive director of Food Lifeline, and maybe some ways about how we can all help as a community come together. But first, I wanted to talk to Ellen Brown. She is the director of food resources for Food Lifeline. And what was interesting about the article that I read in the paper a couple of weeks ago about the state's emergency food storage facility that they have down in Pfeiffer, Tacoma, I want to say, I'm just fascinated by that. You see mountains, literally floor-to-ceiling mountains of peanut butter, mountains of this and that.
Pasta.
And I want to know how they turn that. How did Food Lifeline take advantage of that? How does the Emergency Food Network in Tacoma take advantage? I just want to know how it works, because I have a good idea of how Food Lifeline works on a smaller scale, but I want to know how the big stuff works. So Ellen Brown is here. Ellen, you told me off the air that you have procured already this year some $13 million worth of food through Food Lifeline to hand out to meal programs and food banks around Washington. Tell us about your job. Tell us about this state warehouse thing that I knew nothing about. All that stuff, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been working at Food Lifeline for about 3 years now. And this has certainly been the most interesting year of my time at Food Lifeline. You know, my budget is generally under $1 million to spend on food, which, and even that I feel so lucky to have. But we are now extra lucky to be in this partnership with the WSDA and Northwest Harvest and Second Harvest over in Spokane, and have been funded to be able to purchase significantly higher volumes of food. We've also been really lucky that we've had a lot of community support. Mm-hmm. So our sort of strategies and approaches towards food sourcing have shifted dramatically mm-hmm. in the past few months. We were highly focused on donated food, and when the supply chain sort of erupted, donations really went away in a major way. Mm-hmm. So we started purchasing food on a really high scale, really focused on non-perishable foods, because that is the easiest thing for our agencies to get out in a fast way. So that rings true for the stockpile you mentioned down in Fife and Kent. They've purchased a huge volume.
Been there?
The warehouse has been there, but not the stockpile. It's a new idea, yeah. Uh-huh. So it came together with the 3-NGO partnership in the state as an idea that sort of replicates what happens at the retail location. So, mm-hmm. you know, Food Lifeline is almost replicable to a distributor for grocery stores, our pantries being the grocery stores. And what happens on a large scale in our food system is that distributors have contracts with their retail outlets, and they save foods for those retail locations. So what happened when the supply chain became a mess is that we had a really hard time accessing food because all of the food was held up in these contracts with retail locations, which makes sense, right? Everyone needs access to food. They want to make sure to hold those things
at a certain price and a certain volume.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So what the state's doing is essentially replicating that, making sure that we have enough of a stockpile so that we don't ever get to a place where if we have another outbreak or we have another shutdown, we don't have access to the food the way we have access to it right now. So we've seen, you know, we saw a huge nosedive in availability, and things have kind of come back up. You know, we were seeing 12-week delays on truckloads we were buying, and now it's down to 2 weeks, which is a little bit more normal. So things have gotten better, but we don't know what's going to happen in the next 4 months.
Well, how do you fund all of a sudden $13 million worth? Is the state jumping in to help fund this?
The state's been helping quite a bit. We've had a lot of really, really important private funders as well that have contributed. Linda could tell you more about this, but there's Philanthropy Northwest has come up with a fund, the Washington Food Fund, that a lot of private investors have helped us with support.
Okay, so now I see a picture in the Times of these mountains of peanut butter, we'll say, or mountains of Berea pasta.
Yep.
And I know from being a board member at Food Lifeline that, you know, there's expiration dates on all of this and that we cannot distribute it once the expiration date is gone, right? So how does the state managing to keep this food fresh in these mountains coming up and down, up and down?
Yeah, it's all about turns. It's all about tracking the inventory, and it's all about turning that inventory, which is really interesting, right? Because this warehouse was here before, but this wasn't something that this part of the WSDA had a lot of expertise in before. So they're learning immensely.
So you're teaching them. So
we're all learning from one another, mm-hmm. I would say. Mm-hmm. They've really quickly got up to speed on how to buy all this mountains of food and got it into the facility, and now we're starting to see distributions from that facility. They're sending out. We're receiving 400 pallets right now.
No way! Facility.
Yeah.
400 pallets?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep. And we're lucky in that we had turned on a new facility for Food Lifeline down in the Soto neighborhood a few months ago. So we have the extra capacity to bring in those pallets and get them moving through our system as well. But, you know, if someone 6 months ago said, you need to take 400 pallets next week, that would have been a real problem.
Right. And we're going to find out, because it's really interesting, too, how Food Lifeline deals with their orders. You know, now you're ordering from this big warehouse, and now all these food bank and meal programs order from you. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting in my mind how that whole process works.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is there still a hole in your supply chain, or is there still things that need to be put in there, like canned chicken or, you know, things like that?
Yeah,
proteins.
Yeah, absolutely. We're definitely still seeing some pretty significant gaps. So back around May, we started to hear, you know, canned fruits and vegetables are going to be really hard to find until we harvest more domestically and then we can them. So we're still having a little bit of a trouble sourcing those types of things. But non-perishables are starting to come back. Manufacturers are really starting to come back, which is great. Less holes than we were before.
Yeah. And you still have partnerships, too. I know it wasn't that long ago, maybe a couple years ago, when the government said, okay, here's 60 tractor-trailer loads of pork. What are you going to do with it? And then you have to find a freezer holding for 60 trailer loads of pork.
Yeah.
That's and not then just, you got that's that not redistribute, my freezer.
Redistribute that to all these meal programs in a size they can handle. They can't handle a 1,000-pound tote, right? You guys have to break them down and do all that. Well, we're going to discuss that in the next segment about how that's working because, you know, a lot of these food banks around our neighborhoods, Food Lifeline, they all depended on corporate support, corporate volunteers, individual, often elderly volunteers. And so we're going to find out how Food Lifeline is dealing with that.
But I'm very happy to see that the state of Washington is piling up and making progress in that section. Yeah. I mean, at least we'll be preventive instead of being running behind. So that's very awesome for the next time that we need it.
All right, when we come back, we're going to continue the conversation with Linda and Ellen about Food Lifeline and Washington State's stockpiling process on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society Radio Show. Tom Douglas here.
Jerry Rogero, the chef in the hat.
And Chef, we are continuing the conversation about Food Lifeline and the Washington State Emergency Food Network and all the things that are out there to protect our citizens. And one of the things that I didn't learn until later in my years as a board member of Food Lifeline, that they are considered first responders.
Right.
So they have I guess you would call it a fiduciary responsibility they have a process that they go through when, like, there's a big flood or a tsunami or something. We didn't know it was going to be a pandemic, but
emergency, as a matter of fact.
Yeah,
any
exactly.
Kind of emergency.
So we're going to talk to Linda Najat, the executive director, about that. Also coming up. As long as we're talking about food, we might as well talk about some trashy food. We've got a Cheeto tasting coming up in the next segment. You don't want to miss this. And I just don't know what else to say, how this ended
Did
up on
you
our...
you say you don't want to miss this?
A Cheeto tasting. Yeah, a mac and cheese Cheeto tasting. So, you oddly enough, my daughter is going to join us for that one, Loretta, because she loves mac and cheese, and she's going to tell us if these are a worthwhile investment for your food future. But now let's get back to Linda Najat. Welcome to the show, Linda.
Thank you. Thanks
Hello,
for having
Linda.
Me.
Linda's one of my heroes. She's been running Food Lifeline for many, many years as executive director and has done a fabulous job and has seen the growth of Food Lifeline, sadly, skyrocket.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, right? So tell us about your job and maybe you heard Ellen in the previous segment talk about the Washington State warehouse in Fife, which is kind of newly full of food. And so tell us about... what that means to you.
You bet. So my job leading Food Lifeline really requires just trying to look around the corner and understand what the challenges are that our system faces in the next weeks and months. And we're really clear that while this pandemic has upended the food system, has required us to build all new approaches for how we both source and get food out into the hands of families facing hunger, we're also clear that we probably haven't seen the worst yet.
Mm-hmm.
We're expecting over the course of the next 3 months for need to peak. And by the end of this calendar year, we anticipate that it could be as many as 1 in 5 Washingtonians who are having a difficult time putting food on the table. So our system is working really, really hard to try and prepare for that and to try and think through what contact-free food distribution looks like when cold weather sets in and the rainy season starts. So lots of challenges and things to think about as we prepare for the coming weeks and months.
And also the fresh food changes drastically when the weather goes too cold.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. You bet. We're really thinking a lot about how, you know, these last few months have required that our system stop focusing on fresh foods and produce and shift to shelf-stable and contactless distributions. Over the course of the past 6 to 8 weeks, our system has figured out ways to reintroduce both those nutritious, fresh items into the food stream, but also to provide more choice to people experiencing hunger so that they're not just getting a box that someone packed for them. They're actually getting to choose what goes into that box, and it matches with their dietary needs and with their food preferences and with their culture. And we don't want to see those gains go away. So we really want to be thinking about how we can continue to source the fresh produce, continue to find those items that allow folks to eat the foods of their culture and of their dietary needs. So lots of work to do.
Because even in a crisis like today, there's still plenty of food out there available.
That's right.
Fresh
Absolutely.
Food, that is.
And yes.
We just need to have the people bring it or picking it up, or the distribution is
really organized. Yeah,
the distribution is where the kink is always coming in through the pipeline. So.
That's right. Yeah, and it's a new set of kinks with the pandemic, yeah. Right? Our system is so dependent on community volunteers to help us sort and pack and prepare foods for distributions, and it's just not safe in the same way for us to have that many people coming into our facilities and helping us with that work. So we're doing things like partnering with farmers who have surplus products and packing sheds who could then take various truckloads of product and pack it into some assorted boxes for us so that a family might receive some apples and some onions and some potatoes and some fresh fruit. So things that we have relied on volunteers for before, we're needing to really creatively problem solve. And not just Food Lifeline, but the agencies that we serve are also really needing to think in those new creative
ways. Right, like University Food Bank needs that very same thing, right? Because they relied on seniors a lot of times to come in and help repack those boxes.
That's right.
And I was saying in the last segment, like, Food Lifeline doesn't just get, you know, a one-pound box of pasta, right? They get case loads, or they'll get a 1,000-pound tote of cabbage. All that stuff can't go to a kitchen, like a commissary kitchen, as a 1,000-pound tote. They have nothing to do with it.
That's right.
So that has to go down into 10-pound bags, we'll say, or even smaller. Mm-hmm. And that's what the volunteers did. How are you dealing with that? Is the National Guard helping? I mean, who the heck is helping do this?
It's been extraordinary to see so many different segments of the community step forward to help. We have been able to partner with an incredible company, Prologis, who donated a 166,000 square foot warehouse to us. Mm-hmm. The National Guard stepped in and sent us 252 National Guard troops to work in that warehouse. We borrowed 25 conveyor lines from our partners over at the Idaho Food Bank. Ellen and her team have purchased almost $14 million worth of food through financial support that came from the Federal CARES Act through the state and mm-hmm. the Department of Agriculture. I mean,
you still need freezers and fork trucks and
absolutely.
Hand trucks and all that stuff,
you
right?
Bet. Than ever.
It's more than ever, mm-hmm. more than ever. And, you know, I'm really, really happy to share that our community's support has been significant enough that we've been able to add trucks to our fleet. We've been able to add forklifts and pallet jacks. We've got lots of new capacity, but we've also never seen the kind of need that we're experiencing now. And as fast as we're running, it feels like it's not even fast enough yet. Yeah.
Right.
So, right.
I was thinking, since kids are not going back to school, or a lot of kids are not going back to school, you know, they used to have OMEC. They should have a new class dedicated to social hunger in America and dedicate that to come and sort the food.
And now, well, not just sort the food, but how to cook it, too, at home.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these kids depended on schools for their hot meal of the day.
Right.
And now they don't have that opportunity. You know, so it's there's all sorts of bricks that are kind of falling in on our system.
Absolutely. Yeah, there absolutely are. Yep.
What is, I know when I left the board a year or two ago, we were at about 40 million pounds of food distributed. You've probably done that already this year.
At the end of our fiscal year, June 30, we had distributed 75 million pounds of food last year. Yeah, and just in June alone, 13 million.
Yeah, so you're doubling your capacity mm-hmm. overnight. Mm-hmm. My sister, who runs the Emergency Food Network in Tacoma, saying very much the same thing, that it's happening all over our state. And
absolutely.
And then Food Lifeline is working with you guys on this project?
You know, we're working in, we have a joint NGO partnership.
I said Food Lifeline. But
you did, but I
meant Northwest Harvest.
That's right, Northwest Harvest and Second Harvest.
So let's go back to that. So Northwest Harvest, you're involved with now also?
We're partnering with Northwest Harvest and Second Harvest. So our three organizations are the largest food distribution centers serving hunger relief organizations statewide. Between us, we have kind of divided the state up into three regions. Each of us is acting as the lead distributor for one of those regions. So Food Lifeline is serving 13 counties of Western Washington. Each of them are serving 13 other counties in Washington.
That's good. It eliminates some duplicity and things like that.
It does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you for coming down, both of you guys, Ellen Brown and Linda Najat of Food Lifeline. We appreciate your efforts and all the work you do every day.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you again. And if somebody wants to donate to Food Lifeline, what do they do?
Just go to foodlifeline.org, and you'll find lots of ways to help. I just also want to really encourage folks to find their local food bank in their neighborhood and to provide some financial support there, too.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Up next, we're going to have a surprise tasting panel here at the Hot Stove Society. And Chef Terry is going to probably double over in angst on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Hot Stove Society Radio Show. Tom Douglas here.
Terry Rotor, Roller Chef in the Hat.
And we are going to jump into something that I am most... I feel like at the end of this segment, I'm going to be a damaged human being.
Well, I feel like...
And if I'm going to be, you're going to be even worse.
I'm going to try it, but I really can't understand it right this moment.
All right, so here we are. We have, in front of us right now at the Hot Stove, we have a lineup of five different Cheetos. And we have a lineup of three different Cheeto mac and cheese tasting portions.
Which supposedly I just learned that it is the biggest trend in America right now. Like you have to buy it online, you have to bid on the Cheetos.
And let's find out about that. How did this segment come to be? Amy Richardson, our assistant producer, our associate producer, our co-producer, however you'd like to be identified, is going to tell us about how she dreamed up this segment.
Well, it was an Instagram dream.
What do you mean by that?
It just was all over Instagram.
Okay.
It was all over. And we read all of these articles and really thought that we could torture Tom and Terry with the biggest sensation going on right now.
In the whole country.
In the whole country. It is sold out, so we had to bid on it on eBay.
You did not.
I did, too.
Whose money did she...
I did.
Take away her company credit card.
Yeah. You already did. This is my donation, and it's
You felt strong enough that you spent your own money on this.
Every cent to torture you two.
Okay, I looked them up, and they're only 98 cents, so $3 isn't that big a deal.
Mm-hmm.
Because you bought three boxes, right?
I bought three boxes for $36.
What do you mean, $36?
$36.
For Cheetos.
For the boxes on eBay.
Because they're short supply?
They're short supply. They are sold out. You can't find it.
And you paid $36 for $3 worth of Cheeto pasta.
Gladly. I feel like this is
you are
well
a sick
worth
woman.
It.
You are a sick woman.
I okay. can't believe you. I can buy you a nice meal for $36.
Yeah.
That's Luke.
The great part, it arrived at my house in a box that had fragile all over the box. All sides of the box.
Uh-huh. I'm surprised you didn't say danger.
Danger flaming hot.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Well, my daughter, you know, Loretta, your
yes,
coworker, the general counsel for our company, is a mac and cheese fan.
She is.
And Terry and I, not so much.
No.
But you're forcing us to try it today. So we thought that if we had to try it, she had to try it. So Loretta Douglas, tell us how you got involved in this mutiny, this radio show mutiny, I will call it.
Well, I love to torture my dad, so naturally I was inclined. And on top of that, Cheetos are one of my favorite snacks ever.
Your mother, too, you know.
Yes, my mother as well, especially the cheddar jalapeno flavor, which I think is criminally underrated. So when I saw that there was a cheddar jalapeno flavor of this boxed mac and cheese, it was enough for me. I was hooked.
And so that's how you got involved here. You just had to try it. And at $36 sitting in front of you, how do you feel about it now?
I mean, I do wish it was a little later in the day for flaming mac and cheese.
It's not the price. It's not the goods. It's just, it's early in the morning.
But I'm excited. Yeah, I'm ready.
Now, one of the things Madeline, our producer, did was hand us all these bowls, and you did too, but without spoons. Now, is this a finger food?
There's a spoon next to you.
Oh, there's a spoon over here, tucked under my computer. I thought maybe it was supposed to be
part of the bowl.
Part of the torture is that you have to put your face in the bowl.
So this picture will be on our Facebook page, right?
Oh, yeah.
So
there
is an orange, there is a kind of yellow-orange, and then there's a bright red.
Yes.
What are the flavors here?
We have original Cheeto, cheddar jalapeno, and flaming hot.
Okay. And then it looks like you've garnished them, too.
Yeah, there is a nice sprinkling of crushed Cheetos in their respective flavors on top.
Did that come in the box, or did you choose
it's
that garnish?
It's a recommendation on the box. From Food and Wine Magazine.
From Food and Wine Magazine.
From Food and Wine Magazine.
This is ridiculous.
I'm cutting my subscription.
So not only did you go online and you bid against other poor people for their box of mac and cheese, but you paid, you said 360%, but you paid a lot more than 360%.
Yeah, I'm bad at math.
No, if they're a dollar and you paid over 10 36 per box.
That's a lot. Yeah.
Okay. So I am not one to judge.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
We know that.
That is news to me.
Especially not before, like we just did.
So tell us the how you'd like us to go about this tasting.
I think original first, which is the furthest to the left.
Uh-huh.
Then cheddar jalapeno is in the middle and flaming hot.
And I want our listeners to know, we're only doing this for you, for our faithful listeners.
And for me a little bit.
And for Loretta a little bit.
So I'm trying to understand. This is mac and cheese with Cheetos added, right?
No.
The powdered flavoring that comes with it to make the mac and cheese is supposed to be Cheeto flavored.
Have you ever done a Kraft mac and cheese?
The answer is no. Yes. Annie's.
So you know how the little cheese.
Yeah.
Same idea, but it's supposed to be the flavor profile of the Cheetos.
Got it. And then you added the fresh. You call it the fresh Cheeto on
the
top.
The fresh crushed Cheeto.
The summer Cheeto.
It needs a little garnish.
Yeah. Where is maybe an herb would be nice.
I was going to say, where is the parsley at least?
Yeah. Okay, so that's
original. Surprisingly mild.
Nondescript.
Yeah.
Nothing interesting about that. But I know you would eat it.
Oh, yeah.
And all of it.
No question.
Okay. Now we're going to move on to the cheddar jalapeno.
My love of cheddar jalapeno Cheetos runs so deep that in my welcome gift bags at my wedding, I gave everybody a full-size bag of cheddar jalapeno Cheetos.
Not just a little single serving.
Jumbo.
Jumbo-sized bag. Did you have to bid up for those online also?
No.
Okay.
So just so everybody's clear,
that
I'm taking a second point of that.
What's interesting about this whole process is you're not trying a thing.
Do you want to grab a spoon? You're going to try mine.
She's laughing.
Yeah, she's just laughing. She's laughing that we're actually eating it.
The cheddar jalapeno tastes just like the Cheeto.
It does, and I got to say, I like it better than the plain because it actually tastes like something.
Mm-hmm.
We have a saying in Prosser at our farm.
Okay, so let's clarify something. You're going from dried product that could take a man on the moon to Prosser, Washington, the farm of real vegetables.
We have a salsa that Carmen, our friend who works with us in Prosser, that she loves on everything, and it's super hot. And I call it cancer salsa because it's got about 8 different food dye colorings in it to make it the weird kind of green-blue color that it is. So now here we are presented with a...
It's so bright red that I think I got to...
It's like the oddest red.
I was squinting when I was looking at it.
Yeah.
Whew. They didn't forget to put the hot stuff in there. That's good.
It's red number 40 and yellow number 5.
Uh-huh.
Yellow number 6.
Mm-hmm.
And blue cheese.
And blue cheese. Blue dye or blue cheese?
Blue cheese.
Blue cheese.
There's real cheese in there. See?
Yeah.
I would say the middle one is my favorite.
That could be the worst mac and cheese I've ever tasted.
Well, yeah.
Flaming hot of... Yeah. What do you call the flaming hot?
Flaming hot Cheeto, yeah.
Flaming hot Cheeto mac and cheese.
Nice.
I'm actually surprised. So often they use the word flaming or super hot or something, and it's not very spicy.
It's actually not. I mean, I'm not that big of a spice. It's okay. I mean, it's not too hot for me. I would eat it, but.
The flaming hot Cheetos, they do make an even hotter. They don't make it in the pasta, but they do make an extra flaming hot Cheeto. But I think, I mean, they still want you to eat the whole bag, so they can't kill you on one Cheeto, right?
So let's summarize this. So Cheeto invented a powder that tastes like Cheeto that's added to a pasta, and then you can add to your pasta. And then if you want to get really fancy, you can buy a bag of Cheeto on the side and decorate your whole macaroni and cheese with that.
Absolutely.
More texture.
That is profound. Okay. And this is the hottest thing on Instagram in America right now.
Yeah. Food-wise, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's not that it's beautiful muskmelon season or lovely ripe peaches.
Eggplant to
or
die
watermelons
for.
Are really coming on.
This is what the people want.
I didn't know you guys were such snobs.
Jeez. I didn't realize that August was Cheeto season.
Yeah.
I shook the tree and they all came down.
Well, here's what I'll say about this in a non-judgmental way. I'm so ashamed of our team right now.
I can't believe they came up with this.
Well, I think the smirks on their face were somewhat, this was planned. This was a planned mutiny.
Absolutely.
Of what is the quality part of our show, which is lovely food and wine people.
It is, though, very nice of you to bring a phenomenon I had no idea about that was going on in this country. And I'm very...
Are you appreciative, Chef?
I'm stunned to see what's going on that I don't know about.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're appreciative because I want to watch you finish each of those bowls of Cheeto mac and cheese.
Let's not push it. I didn't say I like it. I just said... what I said, more importantly, is I'm stunned that this whole thing was going on and I had no idea.
Yeah. Tom and Thierry on trend.
I thought people were focusing on fresh and summery and all that. And
they're focusing on mutiny of good taste.
Yeah, I guess, you know.
And 98 cents.
Mutiny of the bounty.
And $36 for $3.
That's called $12 a box.
Or 1,200%
markup you pay.
I'm definitely in the wrong business.
And after this, it was worth it. I would have paid $60.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
After this?
This is amazing.
Debacle that's happened on our lovely radio show?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, fine. Okay, thankfully, we're going to have a new segment coming up now. We can get rid of this stuff because I'm going to vomit soon. It's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia, and now we get to turn the tables and torture Loretta.
That's right.
With some great questions on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Time for the Hot Stove Society radio show Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. Woo! What would the acronym be for that? I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Thierry Roturo, the chef in a hat.
Tasty Trivia is brought to you by Rub With Love, handcrafted, versatile rubs, sauces, and mustards that add a flavorful kick and a whole lot of love to just about any meat, fish, or vegetable. Look for Rub With Love products in your local grocery store or butcher shop, or find them online at tomdouglas.com. You know, we've invited Loretta Douglas,
yes,
my daughter, and also general counsel for our company. Since we were her Petri dish last segment, she's going to become ours this segment. See what kind of player she is when
Loretta,
it comes to
Loretta, I hope you're
trivia.
Ready for this.
I'm not ready.
Today's lucky winner will receive a radio show apron plus a Rub With Love gift pack, including our veggie rub, our pork rub, and a triple garlic teriyaki sauce.
And today we are playing for listener and fan Glenn Kramer, who actually commented that the pork rub is his favorite out of all of the rubs. Well, so he'll be very excited to receive
more
this.
More supply coming in.
More supply coming for you. Terry, you are up first. Are you
Go
ready?
Ahead.
Triple Crown, Arapaho, and Thornless Chester are all varieties of
pulses.
What? Arapaho and Thornless Chester. That's your emphasis.
Chestnut?
Blackberries.
Oh. But you
I
know
was
what?
Going to say artichoke.
Yeah, I was thinking of something with thorns.
Okay. Which cake derives its name from the French word for lightning?
For lightning?
You don't get
Éclair.
Any hints. It's a French word. You don't get any.
Éclair.
Correct. What was the original color of Peeps marshmallow candies? White, yellow, pink, or blue?
I'm going to go with blue.
False. It is yellow.
I knew that. I was just kidding.
Peeps, okay. They're little chicks. Chicks aren't blue.
Right. I don't even know. Yes, go ahead.
How do you pronounce tines? Forks, tines, teens?
Tines.
Tines, okay. How many tines does a fondue fork have?
Three.
Two.
Three. There's one in the middle and one on each side. Okay, never mind.
Answer is two.
Two is right. Okay. I got to set
up. You're having a tough day there,
okay.
Chef.
I got to set
one
at home.
One for four here. As of 2017, which country is the world's largest producer of bananas? India, China, Ecuador, or the Philippines?
I'm going to go with Ecuador.
False. It is India.
Oh, the India is not a winner?
They now produce the most bananas
right,
in the world.
That's a country, too.
Woo, that's a one.
Compared to Ecuador.
Loretta, you're in good hands.
Loretta, I have a fighting chance now.
You have
a fighting chance, Loretta.
Have a big chance to fight this.
Okay, Tom. What?
No, Loretta's going next. I always bring up the rear.
Oh, sorry.
Plus, I feel like you might have tried to give Loretta easier questions.
No, not at all. Maybe just a little.
I really hope so.
Okay, Loretta, what country does Gouda come from? Sweden, Denmark, Iceland, or the Netherlands?
Mac and cheese.
The Netherlands.
That is correct.
Yes.
Good job.
Mm.
In which 1942 movie did Rick Blaine utter the immortal words of all the gin joints in all the towns and all the world, she walked into mine while listening to Sam play the piano? This is a generational one. You can blame Amy for this.
Humphrey Bogart?
I have no idea.
It's okay. Casablanca. hey, never seen it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Never seen it? What kind of parents do you have?
No, bad ones, apparently.
Which type of cocktail is served in a copper mug?
Mule, Moscow Mule.
Correct.
Wow.
Nice watermelon.
She's
yeah, she knows. Watermelon contains how much percentage of water? 52% or 92%?
92%.
Correct. And last question. What was Ronald Reagan's favorite treat? Jelly beans, M&Ms, an apple, slice of cheesecake, or chewing gum?
I feel like you wrote these for someone older than me. M&Ms.
Close. Jelly beans.
Okay.
What was close about that? Individual.
Close.
They're small little okay. nuggety candy.
You get 2 out of 5. You're doing great.
Great.
Okay. Tom, bringing up the rear. Which form of wood is usually used to smoke ham?
And so I'm going to say maple.
Hickory was correct.
Hickory.
What is the average number of grapes needed to produce a bottle of wine? 1,000, 600, or 1,600?
600.
Correct. As they start picking all those for the harvest.
622.
Who said candy is dandy but liquor is quicker? Ogden Nash, Dolly Parton, or Johnny Cash?
Ogden Nash, Johnny Cash, or Dolly Parton?
Correct. Candy is dandy but liquor is quicker.
I want to go with Johnny Cash.
Yep.
Ogden Nash.
Ogden Nash.
Oh.
Okay. Your beloved question. Which of the following flavors is not a Cheeto brand flavor? Cheddar jalapeno, white cheddar, strawberry, barbecue cheddar, or flaming hot asteroids?
Really? Strawberry. Wow.
Which of the following
is not a Cheeto brand flavor?
An official flavor from the Cheeto brand.
Correct.
I'm going to say white cheddar.
That is actually not correct. The correct answer is barbecue cheddar.
Barbecue
there is no barbecue cheddar brand.
Strawberry Cheetos?
They do have strawberry Cheetos. Mm. Our Cheeto producer, Amy Richardson, told me that they have been developed and sold.
I thought that was a joke. I mean, this is actually a strawberry Cheeto.
I knew that was
in Japan.
Too obvious to not be.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
All right. Last question. What kind of cheese is traditionally used in making tiramisu?
Mascarpone.
Correct. Yes. Wow. Okay.
Dang it.
Right. Hi, with Loretta.
Hi,
with
the whole show.
In your name, Chef.
Yes.
I'm going to win.
So, since Terry lost, we're going to fund the winning prize. And Glenn Kramer's going to win the radio show apron plus a gift pack of Rub with Love products, the veggie rub, the pork rub, and our triple garlic teriyaki sauce. If you want to be part of the show, you can join the community on Facebook at Hot Stove Society Show. You're listening to us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. The show is produced by our team, Madeline Dow Pennington and Amy Richardson. Sound and production by Mark Goodnow from the Production Foundry, and the editor is Sean Don't Call Me Dottore. Remember, if you miss any episode of Hot Stove Society on Cairo Radio 97.3, you can listen via podcast. Just subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you for listening and have a great weekend.